Well, hi folks, welcome back to Naturally Adventurous. This is Ken and Charlie. Despite leading a pretty full-on trip there in Thailand at the moment, Charlie has carved out a little bit of time to record another episode. And this episode is going to be about his recent time on the Ryukyu Islands, which is politically part of Japan, right? But sort of biogeographically, maybe it's the extreme edge of the Pacific region. I don't know. It's this fascinating place. It's sort of between Japan and Taiwan, right?
Yep. It's an interesting place. It's kind of subtropical forest. So it just made it into my section of the World Habitats book that we did. I did the sort of Indo-Malaya, kind of tropical Asia section, which didn't include Japan, but did include those Southwest Islands. Yeah, so, and it's got quite a special place in my heart.
I'm trying to remember when we did, I think a bird from these islands was definitely in your lifetime top 10 birds. And I don't remember if it was number one. It was in the top couple, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, we will.
These islands, I've been a lot of places and know a lot about world geography. They still seem quite exotic to me. Actually, that region in general, just sort of the Pacific islands. Yeah, I don't know a lot about them, and they just seem very distant from anything. Now, Ryukyus, I guess, are relatively close to Japan and Taiwan, but yeah, I think they have a certain cachet. Big part of World War II, I guess. That's probably what most people know about those islands.
And there's still U.S. bases on Okinawa. They've got it was the last place in Japan that was returned to Japanese control. You know, I think it was kept, what was it, until the 70s maybe?
Really?
By the U.S. It's recent and it's got a very strong presence there. I guess at the end of the Second World War, there was very little kind of protein and food around. So the U.S. brought food over to feed people because there wasn't enough food there. And one of the foods that they brought over was Spam. And Spam is still considered like traditional Okinawan food now. There's like these Okinawan dishes that have Spam, like stir-fried with other vegetables and stuff. It's and things like tacos are like really, it's considered Okinawan food, you know. So it's almost some kind of US culture and Western culture has kind of infiltrated Okinawa a bit more than the mainland Japan, and it always has been a very different place to Japan. It wasn't part of Japan before. It was a separate kingdom. Yeah, the sort of Japanese invaded and they made it illegal for the local people, the Okinawans, to have any weapons, any swords or anything like that, so they wouldn't revolt against them. And so in secret, the people, they started doing martial arts, just with their hands, with their empty hands, their karate. So, you know, and of course, karate is a big part of my life. So that's another very close thing that I have with Okinawa. You know, it's a birthplace of karate, and I love it. I always wanted to go there. When I first went to live in Japan, I was given an option of where I wanted to. You know, I could give my preference of where I wanted to go, and my number one place I wanted to go was Okinawa. I didn't get there until later, but it's a very interesting place.
Is there a different language? Is there like an Aboriginal language, Okinawan?
There is. They call it a dialect of Japanese, but when you get down there and you hear it, it's got no relation to Japanese. I mean, it's like completely... Most of the things they consider dialects in Japan, they just have a different ending or one or two different words. Every word is different in Okinawa. You know, it's a little bit of a farce to call it a dialect and not a separate language. But there's relatively few people speak this Okinawan dialect. It's mainly the old locals. And there's a lot of people that have come from, you know, the main islands to live in Okinawa. So it's a bit of a mix And then, of course, you've got the American influence and, you know, the foreigners that are living there. So, but yeah, there is kind of a language, yeah.
I would imagine it's a big vacation place for Japanese from the main islands, a little bit more southern, tropical, warm.
It is, yeah. And it's become quite a popular place for other Asian countries to visit. There was, before COVID, a direct flight to Okinawa from Bangkok. Huh. And there's a lot of Koreans going there, Taiwanese, mainland Chinese. Yeah, a lot of different Asian nationalities. When we got to the airport, I just couldn't believe how busy it was. You know, thousands of people there. And one of the clients that arrived, they were like, is this like a really big city? And I'm like, no, not really. It's pretty small. But it just has this huge population of tourists.
And I suppose tropical birding offers an extension there because it has several pretty cool endemic birds, right?
Yeah. So we've been doing this winter tour for a long time, you know, 10 plus years. And that's a popular thing. That's like a 2-week tour. And years ago, I designed like a spring tour that would go to Okinawa, which is the best time to go there. You know, all the some of the breeding birds are back and you get some migrants and all the resident birds are all starting breeding and quite easy to see. And we could never sell it. Nobody seemed interested in going. And we just, every year, we managed to run this winter in Japan tour, which is what, you know, it's got these big draw cards. We did, not so long ago, I think I did my top 5 Hokkaido birds or something like that. We chatted quite a bit about Hokkaido and all these big targets. But yeah, nobody really wanted to do this spring tour. And in the end, I thought, why don't we just do an extension to the winter tour? You know, there's a few migrants that are not there, but, you know, most of the endemics, the residents, and you can, they're more difficult, but you can still see them. So for the last 2 years, we've run this Ryukyu extension. Do you know the difference between Okinawa and Ryukyu and Nansei, Shoto, and it's got a bunch of different names?
No. I assume these aren't all synonyms.
Now, well, some are. The Nansei Shoto just literally translates as the Southwest Islands or Island Chain. The Ryukyu Islands, it includes Okinawa, which is several islands, and then also some other islands between Okinawa and the rest of Kyushu, the main southern island. And those are actually part of Kagoshima Prefecture. So the Ryukyu Islands consist of islands belonging to 2 different prefectures. But, you know, biogeographically, they're fairly similar. You know, they've got a few kind of joint endemics and things like that. So, yeah, when we say Ryukyu, we include Okinawa and also the Kagoshima Islands, which includes Amami. And on this extension that we run, we go to Okinawa Island and Amami Oshima, which is a big island of Amami. So we do 2 islands.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the map and some of these islands of get islands, very close to Taiwan. But are these all Japanese possessions? Like Yonaguni and Taketomi?
Yeah, no, Yonaguni is quite famous because there's quite a few birds on the Japan bird list that have only been seen in Yonaguni. These very kind of tropical things that come as vagrants. So it's like the Brits will go to the Scilly Islands or whatever, you know, to get vagrants, and the Americans will go to where, like Attu or something like that. But yeah, the Japanese twitchers would go to Yonaguni.
There's a little island right off of New Guinea, though, that's Australian territory. That's probably the analog for Australia listers as well. Yeah, interesting. It makes me wonder why Japan hung on to those. I mean, they colonized Taiwan, but eventually gave that up, but didn't give up those islands, even though the islands are only, 100 miles off of Taiwan.
Yeah, I mean, I think they have a longer Japanese history there. But yeah, I'm not sure. I have to go to the history books for that one.
Interesting stuff. Well, we should get into your top 5, because you have to get some sleep tonight. So we'll in typical naturally adventurous fashion, we'll start with number 5 and work our way up to number 1. Yeah, your number 5 highlight of your recent visit is a mummy woodcock.
Do you find that strange that a tiny little island has its own endemic woodcock?
Yeah, that is strange, for sure. Woodcocks are weird things, though. I mean, it's just kind of this random scattering of woodcocks. They're not sort of consistently around the world, but it fits the pattern of the lack of a pattern.
Yeah, I mean, Amami Island at the moment has like 3 endemic species, but you know, there's another one that may be split, a woodpecker, and then there's some other ones that are mainly on Amami and a few of the neighboring islands, but 3 good endemics. And it's not like little warblers or something. You know, there's a jay. It's like purple jay with a yellow bill and a woodcock, and then this huge thrush. It's a really interesting island. And it's always been a bit of an enigma. And I visited the first time, it must be about 20 years ago. It's when I was living in Japan. You know, I knew about this island and I really wanted to get there. And I think I took a ferry there from Kagoshima. And I was camping. I had a tent. And the forest was about 15 kilometers away. So I hiked up to the forest from this campsite.
Naturally. You know,
it was funny because when I was... Naturally, yeah. And when I was with the clients and we were going up and up and up on these winding roads, I said, yeah, the first time I came here, I walked this road. And it was just a magical place. And it's this really lush subtropical forest. And it's just full of tree ferns and just dripping with moisture. And it's just, really, really special place. But when I first went there, I had a contact. He was pretty well connected. He was a Japanese bird watcher, and he said he had a friend there. So he hooked me up with his friend, and his friend took me out at night, driving all these mountain roads. And then he kind of points down, and there's this woodcock by the side of the road. So I saw this thing years ago, 20 years ago. So that it would have been last year we did this Ryukyu extension for the first time. You know, I was a bit nervous because I hadn't, you know, seen this bird for 20 years. But I had all this eBird data and I was looking at it. And we had 3 nights on Amami. And because of the lot of the stuff you're looking for is nighttime stuff, you're doing a lot of nocturnal activities. And as Anna mentioned in the mammal podcast, which I just recorded, we were going out, you know, pre-dawn, you know, pre-breakfast, we'd do our first nighttime session. And then, you know, it gets dark around, you know, 5 or 6. So we would stay out till dusk and a little bit later and then go back for dinner and then go back out again. And we did this for 5 days in a row, 3 nocturnal sessions, 5 days in a row. And we were pretty finished by the end of it. And last year, we finally got the woodcock like on the 3rd night after 2.5 days solid searching. Driving all these mountain roads and stuff, and finally we were on this kind of like golf course kind of place and walking around, and I think I played the call, and then this thing kind of dropped in right next to us, and I shone the light and it was just right there. You know, it was quite cool. It was a real high to get at the end of the trip. So I told everybody at the beginning of this trip that I did this year that it's, you know, it could be quite hard. And we went out on the first night, and I think we saw about 30.
Oh, jeez.
I mean, it was absolutely ridiculous. It's one of these things, you know, you warn everybody that it's going to be really difficult.
Right. And then they you kind of look ridiculous.
Everywhere. You can look. and I'm not quite sure where this big disparity came from, why they were so difficult last year and so easy this year. And I went back because I did this extension twice this year. And again, on the second one, they were just everywhere. I think, oh, well, you know, this night we only got 20. And it's like, okay, let's try and beat the record of 20. And we went up, okay, great. Yeah, we got 25 tonight, you know. And they were just, there's another one. And they were just all the way along this road. I mean, you've never seen anything like it, how abundant they were. I know they got very rare a few years ago. They're very susceptible to predation by some invasive predators, which include feral cats and also mongooses. And they've been doing a lot of trapping. So when you're going along looking for all these things, you just say, oh, there's a trap, there's a trap, there's a trap. Like all the way along these roads, there's just traps everywhere. And I think they've really put a lot of effort into trapping these predators. And I think that's made a big difference.
All right, so let's move up to number four, which is Okinawa woodpecker. I'm just looking it up. It's a critically endangered bird. Looks like it's only found on like the top of the mountains on the northern end of Okinawa. And it's a really kind of odd looking woodpecker. It doesn't look similar to any other woodpecker.
I know. It's weird, eh? But it's a Dendrocopus, you know, just like one of these black and white ones. But for some reason, this one is all like plain
brown and brown.
And with some red on it, you know. And it's interesting, if you look at the Amami woodpecker, which will probably be split at the moment, it's still white-backed. It's like halfway between like a black and white woodpecker and this Amami.
Really?
It's really, really dark. So I think this started off as one of these, you know, great spotted type things and ended up just all plain brown. But the reason for that distribution is because all the forest is left, the decent forest is left in the north. Okinawa's pretty developed, eh? It's quite high population density. I mean, it's just like, you know, urban conurbations in the south. But you get further north, and then when you get up to the Kunigami area, you get this nice forest. And I think the reason they're so rare, one of the reasons is that they're like old growth trees. And they did, although there's quite a lot of forest left, I think a lot of the bigger trees were taken out. And they like, I guess, nesting and certainly feeding and banging on these big old, you know, dead trees and stuff like that. So it's become a very rare species. And I think it's about, there's probably around 200 individuals or less. I mean, BirdLife International, they give like population size estimates, and it's in that sort of category of 50 to 249 mature individuals. But my feeling is that it's sort of on the upper end of that, or maybe a bit more. You know, you hear them quite a bit, like drumming. But it's a weird bird. I went there once in May, and I saw it very easily, very vocal. And this thing just flew in and just sat there, and it was just great, you know. But winter is a different kettle of fish. I've spoken to a few people who know Okinawa really well, and they say that's the one that's going to give you some trouble. But last year I just got really lucky. I think we got really good views. My first tour this year, we were driving along with the windows open, and you just kind of drive along, listen out for the call and listen out for the drumming. And if you hear it, you jump out. And we had one fly over the road, and they're big as well, you know. And they've got these little white spots in the wing. This thing flew across the road, and it was drumming on this dead tree next to the road, and we saw it a couple of times on that trip. And then on the last one, again, I was telling everybody, you know, I think we were lucky last time, and we were walking along, and someone said, "Oh, what's that?" And we looked up, and there's this woodpecker just like right above our heads. So I seem to be quite lucky with this bird. But yeah, big, spectacular, rare, very unique. It's got a lot of the things that I like.
And it's in the home of karate.
Karate, yeah.
Cool.
Exactly.
All right, let's move up to number three, which is Ryukyu flycatcher. I'm just looking it up. I really don't know a lot about these birds in this region, but yeah, it's quite a pretty flycatcher, like a Mugamaki type. North Americans might not realize how beautiful some of these old world flycatchers are. Americans think of them as, you know, olive green and or gray birds.
It's funny, in the States, you get these very plain flycatchers and very beautiful warblers. And in the old world, it's reversed. You get beautiful flycatchers and very plain warblers. But it's in the genus Fistedula, I guess. And it's in a complex of flycatchers that are all kind of yellow and black. There's like, I think they were all considered Narcissus flycatchers at a point. And there's four species. There's a narcissus, and then there's one called green-backed, which is quite a rare migrant. There's a yellow-rumped as well, which is a migrant, comes through Thailand. And then there's this Ryukyu flycatcher. And it's a very mysterious bird. It's fairly, how common it is. I mean, I think it's fairly easy. You hear it a lot in spring, not only in Okinawa, but in Amami, like in the humid forest. But in winter, they just kind of disappear. They're supposed to be resident in some places. I think they move a little bit. And I had never seen this thing. I don't know. I'd been to Okinawa and Amami before, and I had my Japanese bird book. I just used to just check things off, and I used to write down where I'd seen them if it was the first time I'd seen it. This is how I kind of started with my birding. Basically, in my Japanese bird book, I didn't have written down that I'd seen this thing in Okinawa. I'd seen it somewhere else, so I may or may not have seen it. And every time I've been back in sort of winter, I just haven't been able to find it. And it's been kind of frustrating. So I've been doing Japan tours now for the past 10 years. Every single year that I've come, I've got a lifer. Which is amazing, because I mean, I'd lived there already for 5 years, yeah. And I'd seen almost all the birds. And there's not that many
species.
And there's not that many species, but every year I go, I see what's around, and I always try and twitch something or just try for some bird that's around, you know. And there's always different stuff around in Japan. It's actually quite an exciting place in winter. There's always some exciting stuff. And I was actually looking for this. One of my biggest nemeses in the world, which is the Japanese night heron. And that was showing in one of the Tokyo parks. And it was seen like the day before I was there. So I dragged all the people. I said, okay, we're going to do some extra birding here. And I dragged them all down to this park to try and get myself a lifer. And it wasn't there. And on the second tour, it had been seen again, I think, the day before. And I went down again and missed it again. And I was like, oh, no. And I really wanted to get my annual Japan lifer, you know, and it just wasn't happening with that bird. And I think there was another bird that someone saw in Hokkaido. It's a black-throated thrush. It was like a vagrant. And I tried to twitch that and missed it. And I was like, oh, God, this is just not working. Anyway, but I kind of e-birded this Ryukyu flycatcher that I know would sometimes stick around, but I just was never able to find this thing. And a guy that I've never met before, but it's another guide. So there's very few international bird guides that speak fluent Japanese. But there's another guy called Brian who speaks like, you know, perfect Japanese. And he leads tours. And he's seen this. And we've got a mutual friend. I've never really spoken to the guy, but we've got a mutual friend. And he'd seen this bird in Okinawa. And he'd put it on as like on a hotspot, but I mean, that could be anywhere, you know, it doesn't really give you specific information. So I wrote to this dude. I said, oh, you know, it's Charlie, how you doing? You know, we've got this mutual friend. And I hear you just saw this Ryukyu flycatcher, you know, can you give me any more information? And he just writes straight back with a GPS point. So there I am, armed with this GPS point of this bird. And we'd kind of finished the main birding. We'd seen all the endemics and stuff in Okinawa. And we're driving back to Naha to fly to the next island. And we had just enough time, like an hour, to swing by this place where this Ryukyu flycatcher had been seen. And we start walking around. And I had never really realized that there was very different forest habitats on Okinawa. I thought it was all this like humid, subtropical, moist forest, but this was at a lower elevation. I went there and it's all kind of dry and viney, and it looks kind of like kind of monsoonal type stuff. It was really interesting habitat that I'd never seen before. And I was walking along and I went to his GPS point, and we're walking along and I hear this little tinkling song. Because I asked him as well, I asked him all these like very specific questions. Did you hear it singing? What kind of habitat was it in? What level in the forest was it in? You know, what was it doing? Was it calling? Was it singing? And he said, he told me, was it a juvenile, an adult? And he gave me answers to all these. And then I hear it singing. He said it was singing. So I was listening out for the song. And I heard it singing, and we're getting closer and closer. And I'm getting that kind of, you know, that tension of like, am I going to see it? And then we start looking up. And a lot of these little flycatchers, they've got these beautiful little metallic melodious songs or tinkly songs, but they tend to sit quite still, you know, so often they're quite hard to spot. So we're all kind of standing there scanning, trying to see this singing bird. And then I see a little flit, you know, it just flies out like a flycatcher, just flies out and back. And I get on it, and then I'm trying to get all the clients on it. I actually had a really good view the first time, and I just wanted to take a photo. And then by the time I'd got everybody else on it, the thing had flown away already, and we had to look for it again. So I didn't get a photo. But it was in this kind of monsoonal, viney forest there. But it was also in a little gorge, and it was in a little dry riverbed, and which was kind of interesting. And it was a juvenile male. And we all got good looks in the end, and then we walked back to the car, and then right next to the car, also in this kind of same type of forest, and also in a little dry gorge, there was another one, like a few hundred meters away. So it seemed, and you know when you haven't been able to find a bird, and you finally see it, and something clicks about the habitat, you're like, oh, it's in this kind of stuff, you know? And it all kind of clicked that this bird must be like a sort of altitudinal migrant that goes from the sort of montane, humid stuff down to this kind of monsoonal, drier stuff, but specifically in these little dry gorges and stuff like that. So I thought, wow, this is fantastic. So it was, they were both juvenile males. I had a little bit of yellow on them, but it wasn't as spectacular as a male. But it's a bird I've been dreaming about for a while, and I've been discussing it with other guides, and where have you seen this? And a friend of ours, James Eaton, this other guide, I was chatting with him about it, and he wrote a paper on them. And we were chatting about them, and he says it's just like a really mysterious bird that very little is known about its movements in the non-breeding season. It was a pretty interesting sighting, really.
And more importantly, the streak is still alive.
The streak is still alive. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting how long I can keep this up.
When the streak dies, that's when you need to give up guiding in Japan. I'm done.
Oh, no, that's not going to happen. That will never happen.
All right, well, let's move up to number two, which is a mommy thrush. It looks like one of these beautiful, kind of intricately patterned, scaly Asian Zuthera thrushes.
Yeah, so this, I think this used to be, I can't remember if it was white or scaly or something like that, but it was the biggest one. It was like the biggest subspecies before it was finally split as a separate species. And when it was split, it was considered critically endangered, I think. So like a super rare bird. And subsequently, I think just in the last year or two, it's been sort of downlisted as vulnerable. So I think they've found out that it's a little bit more widespread. And it's on this island of Amami that's just covered in forest. You know, it's a fairly low population of people and very well-preserved habitat. It's a really interesting bird. It's huge. I mean, it's just an enormous thrush. And I told you last year when we were looking for the Amami woodcock, it took like 3 days. This one, I think we saw on the first morning. We went at dawn to this one place, and it was perched on a wire overhead, singing away. And we all got really good looks at it. And I was like, well, that was a lot easier than I thought. So, of course, I tell everybody, oh, yeah, this should be pretty easy. And, of course, like, you know, 2 days later, we've been trying for it solid and just cannot find this bird anywhere. And we almost missed it on the first tour. And we finally heard it, not singing, but just giving a little high pitch. You do these little high pitch contact calls.
Yep.
And we heard this, and we were waiting around this place for an hour. And I think Ben, the tropical birding guy, Ben, he was co-guiding with me. And he actually saw this thing like hop across the road, and he was like, come on, get over here. And everybody rushes over, and then these things just make themselves scarce very quickly. No one else sees them. And then we're all standing there, and then it sort of hops up on the side of the road, and someone says, oh, look over there. And then it goes down again. And then I think one client and Ben saw it, and then that was it, and they wouldn't come out. So that was a bit, you know, we got it on the trip list, but, you know, not hardly anyone saw this thing. So on a second tour, I'm telling everybody that Lexi's actually going to be quite hard. And we went out to all the usual places, and I think we thought we might have heard it again, and it just wasn't happening. So on the final afternoon, I was like, you know, we can go to this same place again, but, you know, I think our chances are pretty low, or we can just go and go exploring. So we went exploring. We went onto the other side of the island to these little quiet roads that I'd never been to before. And we made a few stops, and I played the tape a couple of times. And I played the tape, and then immediately there was a response, and it was singing. And I think it just flew in into the tree and just sat there right in front of everybody. Amazing views. And I think I'd left my camera in the car, which really annoyed me. That was kind of frustrating.
Sacrificial,
but yeah,
camera.
This bird that... This bird that I've been searching for like 5 days and not a sniff of, suddenly was just easy. But I was really happy to see that. And then further down the road, this same road, we had another pair like singing up in a tree. Really interesting, melodious song. It seems also very different from year to year. This went from being a very easy bird to a very difficult bird. But it was a real relief. I think, you know, when you do a bird of the trip, you know, everybody votes for the bird of the trip. It's kind of skewed towards the birds that you've seen, like, towards the end of the trip.
Yep.
That's what everybody remembers. And these amazing birds you've seen at the beginning, everybody kind of forgets. But, yeah, this thrush was, like, sort of number one on everybody's list, you know, for the whole of Japan, you know, just because we'd struggled so much and then finally got this amazing view. So, it was cool. And there's one more thing about the Amami thrush. After I'd done that 15-kilometer hike from my campsite up to this forest, I saw this bird hopping around in the middle of the road. And I thought to myself, God, I wish I had a camera. And then straight after that, I went and bought my first digital camera to take pictures of birds with. And that was the sort of catalyst of me starting with bird photography. So that was my sort of spark birding photography bird.
And then ironically, you had a great chance to photograph it and didn't have your camera.
Yep, the irony.
You know, when you do an extension to a birding trip to a place that only has a handful of endemics or special birds, there is also a disproportionate pressure as a guide to actually deliver those birds. So there must have been some measure of relief as well connected with this.
It was, yeah, a lot. Yep.
All right, we'll move on to number one. I know this bird has a special place in your heart, and we've talked about it fairly extensively in the past, and this is the Okinawa rail.
So, you know, people always ask you, oh, especially non-birders, they say, well, what's your favorite bird?
What's your favorite bird?
And it's kind of, hey, what's your favorite bird? It's like, God, which of the thousands of birds I've seen, amazing birds that I've seen? You know, it's such a difficult question. But for me now, this is it. This is my favorite bird in the world. I just love it. I love everything about it. I love its rarity. I love how difficult it is to see. I love how it looks. I love the habitat that it's in. I love the place. It's just got everything for me. Do you know what date it was described?
I'm looking at Wikipedia, and apparently it was 1981. That's crazy.
You find that amazing? A huge, colorful rail that's got this loud call is found in 1981.
That is crazy.
It's crazy. I mean, the locals must have known about it.
Sure.
I'm sure. Yeah, but to be unknown to science that late, it's not some little flycatcher or something.
Right, not cryptic, it's not
so
quiet.
Remote. Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing. The place, you mentioned that the Okinawa woodpeckers only found in that forest in the very north of Okinawa, that area is called Kunigami, which is a village. But it also has an old name, which is Yambaru. That's the old name for the northern part of the main island of Okinawa. And the rail, just like a water rail, is Kuina. So this is Yambaru Kuina. It's a Yambaru rail. And it's very famous. Like, most people in Japan, I think, will have heard of Yambaru Kuina. Huh. It's a really, really famous bird. And I think it's often on TV and documentaries and stuff like that. And of course, it's a town bird. When you get into the town, you drive into the town, there's like a 20-foot statue of the Okinawa Rail next to the side. I mean, huge. It's like the size of an elephant bird or something like that. You know, it's just this huge statue of the Okinawa Rail to welcome you to the village.
Daring any bird guide to not manage to find this bird for their clients.
Yeah, it's like, well, if we miss it, we'll just stop here and take a picture of this statue on the way out, you know. And then you pass the statue, and then you get to this visitor's center. It's like the town's tourism information, and they sell souvenirs and have a little food court and stuff like that. So we stop there when we first arrive in Okinawa. We have lunch there, and then we go on to our lodge and start our birding. But we look around the gift shop there, and you've never seen so much memorabilia for one bird. I mean, you've got Okinawa Rail, pretty much everything. There's sake and whiskey and cuddly toys and little stationery and T-shirts and hats and jewelry and little cute. I mean, literally anything you can imagine. There's a huge stuffed toy Okinawa Rail as soon as you walk in the door, and you know, it's just hilarious. I love that shop. It's great. So we went in there, and everyone's like, oh, shall I buy you a T-shirt now? And it's like, no, maybe wait for the way back. You know, we'll just see if we can actually find this thing first. The Okinawa Rail, it's a forest rail. It's not associated with water. And it is quite easy to see in kind of April and May. So Japanese birders that want to see it, that's when they'll go. But of course, you know, I had to start doing this extension in January, February, you know, which is the hardest time to see it. They don't come out of the forest. They stay in. You can hear them. You drive around these mountain roads, and you're hearing them all the time in the early morning and late afternoon. And you've got to try and either find this thing in the forest or try and find it sleeping. So that has been the MO of this tour, is to drive around at night and try and find a sleeping rail up in a tree. And I don't know if they can't fly or don't really fly, but they usually walk up diagonal trunks to get up into a tree at night. And I've seen them doing this. So I think on the first extension, we missed it the first night. The next morning we missed it. The next night we missed it. And then we were leaving the next day. So we were down to the last morning. And I tried where I'd seen it the year before. It wasn't there. We tried in the forest, we struck out, close. You know, we had these things calling close and they just wouldn't come out. And we were really, and this is the bird of the extension. It's the main thing that people want to see, you know. And then you're down to the last morning. It's 6 a.m. And it gets light at, you know, 6:45. And I thought we'd just try one more spot. And I was going all the way through the eBird data and seeing where people had seen them and whatever. And I found a spot along this road. It was like, oh, yeah, sleeping Okinawa Rail, 6 a.m. So we drove down there, parked the car, walking along the road like that. I've got my thermal scope looking left and right along this road. And then I see this red dot. And then I get my light on it. And it's a rail on this big, thick branch, you know, fairly low branch. And I'm like, everybody, look. And you know when you're often pointing things out and it's obviously you're shining the light at it. And people say, oh, where is it? You know, it's like middle of the light. This happens just look in the middle of the light. Obviously, you've got to state the obvious. So I'm like, look in the middle of the light. Oh, I can't see it. In the middle of that, it's right there. And this thing starts walking. I think it would be disturbing it a little bit. It was getting towards morning anyway. It was awake. And it just starts walking along this branch towards these leaves, just ready to disappear inside the tree. And I'm like, look. And then finally, and it was a big group of people. You know, there was maybe like eight people in the group. And then finally, everybody gets it. I was like, okay, no, I've got it. I was like, oh, God, thank God for that. Because it was like last minute. So that was a big success. And yeah, and you know, also when you've got a main target and you've missed it, and you get it right at the end. It's like a real celebratory moment, you know. Everybody's like high-fiving and really happy. So that was cool. And on the second tour that I did there, we'd been out, and it wasn't in this same tree, and it wasn't in the tree we saw it the year before. And I think somebody had glimpsed it in the forest, and you know, it was really unsatisfactory. And what happened after that? We'd been out again before dinner. It had got dark. We came back for dinner on the second night, and we're pulling into the parking lot, and this thing is walking around in the middle of the parking lot. I could not believe it. I think there was some like lights, and they were bringing in insects, and it was running around the parking lot catching insects. And it was incredible. And I thought we were going to miss this thing. And then it walks off and then down this grassy bank, and we all jump out of the car and run towards the fence. And it's close still. I've got my light on it, and we're talking maybe only 10 feet away. And I've got my light, and I'm trying to take pictures. Everybody's taking pictures. And this thing is just walking around in front of us. It was incredible. And then we went out again after dinner looking for an owl. And then I'm looking around for this owl with a scope, and I see this blob. And then we found another one sleeping there, like close. Wow. And we all get nice photos and stuff. So in the end, we saw this thing twice, like really well, after thinking that we were going to miss this thing. So it's a bird that's always kind of, you always feel like you're cutting it a bit fine. It would be easily missable, but luckily on all the tours that I've done now, we've managed to find it.
It makes me think that none of these tourists who come and buy Okinawa rail, sake, and big plush toys actually see this creature.
They're not seeing it. They actually have a little breeding center, like an information center, and they've got a couple of they've got some captive individuals. I've never actually been in there, but I think that's the place where people, you know, the general tourists can see it if they want. But they're not, you know, you need a bit of know-how and a bit of skill to find this bird at night. But I feel like the more that I see it, the more that I know it, and I've got a better idea how to find it. So, but it always seems to keep you on your toes. You know, you're thinking, okay, it was here. This must be a tree that it likes. And you go back there, it's not there. And you find another one, and you go back there, and it's not there again. It keeps moving, and it always seems to be like one step ahead of you. I just wanted to mention one more thing, and that was another very cool thing, was something that I really enjoyed on this extension, on the last one, were the herps. There's an awful lot of endemic herps, really cool ones. It's like salamanders and newts, the Ryukyu swordtail newt, and this what do they call it? A crocodile newt. It's just full of these little bumps, and it looks like it's wearing its rib cage on the outside. And these huge black and green frogs, the Ishikawa's frog. And I saw some last year, and I saw more this year, and there's still more that I haven't seen. So even though I've seen all the birds, I kind of want to go back there and get some more of these cool herps.
Keep the streak alive with herps. Maybe just switch to herps.
Just switch to herps, yeah. But one more thing that I want to mention is that, so our friend Keith, he has an old school buddy. This is like one of his oldest friends that he went to school with, called Mark. And he married a Japanese girl. And she kind of helps us with our bookings and stuff over there. And I've got to know this couple. They've got a 12-year-old son like mine as well. And they've actually moved to Amami now.
Oh,
and
really?
I was kind of going, around this, because they used to live in Tokyo, but they've moved down there now. And I was going around Amami thinking, I could live in this place. I could easily live in this place. And I kept meeting interesting people. I was like, if I lived here, we would be friends. And you're driving around the coast roads, and the sea is crystal clear, turquoise waters with these beautiful, lush forests full of interesting birds and herps and treasures. It's just a magical place there. And I think, you know, if I had to choose a top five places that I wanted to live, I think Amami would be on there.
I'm wondering why Amami is so much less populated than Okinawa. It sounds like Okinawa is almost a big city.
Yeah, especially the south. Yeah, you've got the Naha, the capital, and several other big cities, and it's very developed. But Amami is just a small little provincial island, part of Kagoshima. but it's becoming popular as a tourist destination. But the number of locals that live there is relatively small. And it's so, everybody is so friendly. We were driving along and this car pulls up and we stop. And they were just stopping to say hello. They just they pulled up the car just to, and people in the car were like, what do they want? And said, oh, they just want to say hello. And they were like, hello and welcome to the island. And people were just driving so slowly. I mean, like 30 kilometers an hour. Maybe their speed limit was 50 or something. They were just trundling along at 30 kilometers an hour. It was kind of frustrating. But everybody, the pace of life there is just something else. It's just so, yeah, so slow.
Hmm. It's funny how I think you and I both think a lot in terms of could I or would I live in a given place? And yeah. You know, we both moved around enough that we know that we actually could live in a lot of these places. I suspect that's not a filter that a lot of people are applying to the world.
Yeah, you're right. No, it is something we do. And I think, you know, both of us, we're not completely set on where we want to live. And right. There's always the thought, you know, you're always asking, you're like, could I live here? Would I enjoy living here? But yeah, I think most people are not thinking in those terms. Okay, so there's only one bird that I can choose for my natural sound, and that is the Okinawa rail, which was my number one bird. I won't say it's a beautiful call or song that it does. It's quite raucous, but it really, you know, if I close my eyes and listen to it, I could definitely just put myself in that forest. So yeah, it's quite a sort of atmospheric and special call. So I'm going to play the call of the Okinawa rail. Yeah, it's been fun, Ken, to chat again, as always. Thanks for coming through the Ryukyu Islands with me. Hopefully we'll get there together one day. I'm sure it might happen.
Yeah, I really need to spend some time in Japan. One of these days, one of these years.
It's funny, sometimes you're always hoping that somebody might break their leg or have some kind of accident that you might get subbed in last minute. But yeah, it'll happen one day. Anyway, thanks for joining me, Ken. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Big thanks to our patrons for supporting the show. Here's the Okinawa Rail, and we'll catch you all next time on Naturally Adventurous.